Lucy, Janice, Nick, and Claire. So to start off, I have a question for you to think about. Would you push through a lot of pain if you thought that it might help you to heal your Achilles tendon and prevent you from having surgery? So that's question one. Question two is, would you have your clients do that? So just out of interest, we wanted to have a show of hands if you felt that you most likely would have your clients push through a lot of pain if you thought it would help them. So hands up. So maybe not quite half, maybe. So we're hoping that by the end of the presentation, you may have more information to make your decision on. And we'll see at the end again if you've changed your mind or feel the same. I may forget to change the slide, so remind me if I forget. So here's a quick outline, introduction, methods, results, discussion, and then some recent research that came out that we didn't have time to put into our review. So why did we choose this topic? We chose it because of our own interest in the area, and also because we felt that there has been a growing interest or trend among practitioners in using eccentric exercise to rehab a variety of conditions, one of them being Achilles tendinosis or tendinopathy. We also believe that a closer examination of the literature was necessary if we as practitioners were going to ask our clients to push through a lot of pain. So I'm going to begin with a little bit of background. There are a variety of terms that you might have heard or you may hear if you're looking into this area. So I just wanted to clarify a little bit about them. So Achilles, or chronic Achilles tendinopathy, refers to individuals with a long duration of a painful condition in the Achilles tendon. And chronic Achilles tendinopathy, again, or tendinosis, is a degenerative condition of the tendon, while tendinitis is an inflammatory condition. But in the past, the term tendinitis has been used to refer to what is really a tendinosis. So for the purposes of our systematic review, we are referring to chronic Achilles tendinopathies or tendinoses. So, Achilles tendinosis is one of the most common injuries in runners, although it does occur in other sports as well, and also in individuals who are more sedentary. What causes it is not definitively known, but there are certain predisposing factors. So what are some of them? Basically, they're all a combination of overuse and biomechanical abnormalities. So for example, weak plantar flexors, leg length discrepancy, overpronation, insufficient flexibility, poor footwear, and an increase in physical activity, particularly a sudden increase. Moving on to some of the pathology, using ultrasound and color Doppler, it's been found that in individuals with chronic Achilles tendinosis, they have a thickened Achilles tendon with collagen degeneration and increased GAGs. There are also high levels of glutamate and lactate levels, which some have hypothesized may trigger neovascularization or blood vessels into the area that weren't there before and shouldn't be there. No inflammatory cells were found on examination, supporting the theory that it's not actually a tendinitis. Clinically, some of the signs and symptoms you might see are pain, tenderness on palpation, and sometimes the presence of a nodule, decreased strength, range of motion, and function. The pain may come on gradually or suddenly, and is most often, although not always, associated with tendon loading. So here are some of the conventional treatments that have been used and are still being used for chronic Achilles tendinopathies. You can take a look at those. Note that NSAIDs and some of those things are on there as well. Although in the past, eccentric exercise has been a component of rehab for Achilles tendinopathy, in 1998, an interesting study by Alfredson et al. Came out of Sweden that brought renewed interest in Achilles rehab. In their study, eccentric exercise was used as the primary treatment of choice, and also they asked their patients to push through their pain, and quite a lot of pain, for 12 weeks. So this study was the pivotal article that sort of initiated a series of studies examining pain enduring eccentric exercise, so pushing through pain and doing eccentric as the primary focus and right away. So now Tracy's going to speak to you about how we gathered our information for our review.
Thank you, Lorraine. Okay, so I'm just to tell you a little bit about our methods. So after doing our initial search of all the literature out there before we started our actual systematic review, it became pretty apparent that we were going to have to make a really good operational definition for chronic Achilles tendinosis. In agreement with the literature, we decided or considered symptoms lasting longer than 3 months to be chronic. We decided to look specifically at mid-portion lesions, as they appear to be more prevalent, and they are actually histologically differentiated from insertional tendinosis. So we also limited the search to human adults. Other inclusion criteria, of course, included pain-enduring eccentric exercises, and the outcome measures we were looking at were pain and function. We searched Medline, PubMed, Embase, CINAHL, and Pedro. We talked to experts in the field. We searched reference lists. We conducted hand searches and gray literature searches. And the end result was a whopping 4 RCTs and 4 cohort studies. This slide is just to give you a basic idea of what our search looked like. We started with about 259 articles, and after further investigation, only really 8 fit our inclusion criteria. We categorized our articles using levels of evidence and performed quality assessment on each article. Like other people, we used the quality assessment we used was the Adapton, Megan, and Harris. It was taken from Medlicott and Harris, 2006. It involved a list of 10 criteria. We also used Sackett's level of evidence, which is a 5-point scale, 5 being expert opinion, without critical appraisal, all the way up to 1, which is a high-quality RCT. And you'll notice on here, it's a typo. It's supposed to be scores of 5 or and less are weak. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. And moving on to some results. The age range for the collated group of subjects from all the studies was 19 to 77 years of age, average being about 47 years. The average sex ratio was approximately 2-to-1, male to female. And most studies only used mid-portion lesions in their eccentric groups. However, one study did use a mixed population of mid-portion and insertional lesions. Duration of symptoms averaged 16.4 months. And while not all the studies described the activity history of all subjects in detail, so all subjects did appear to be active prior to their injury. Most were runners, walkers, or sport participants. Method of diagnosis. 5 of the 8 studies used clinical exam and ultrasound. 1 study used clinical exam and MRI. And 2 of the 2 remaining studies used clinical exam solely and had no imaging. We'll talk about the implications of that later in our presentation. So intervention. The Alfredson et al. Group in 1998, in their paper, they described this eccentric protocol. My 2 lovely assistants here are just going to demonstrate it for you. Very carefully. I don't know if I like that up on the chair. Of course, this would be on a low step in a very safe environment, not like this. Okay, so you'll notice Lorraine is rising up concentrically on her non-affected leg, while descending eccentrically on our affected leg, just to isolate the eccentric action of the affected leg. Good. Thank you. Alfredson's group also instructed the patients to work through non-disabling pain and asked them to progressively add weight. And this kind of became the standardized protocol, as 6 of the 8 studies we looked at used the Alfredson eccentric protocol exactly, One used a variation of the Alfredson because they were finding that some of the subjects were getting soreness. So in an attempt to decrease that, they wanted to gradually increase the reps, so that was the only difference. And then one used a protocol that was independent of Alfredson's group, and it was a 12-week series of primarily eccentric exercises. Okay, it's control groups, and we use this term kind of loosely because they weren't actually true empirical controls, but rather a second treatment group using a convention, usually using a conventional treatment, used to compare the results of the eccentric group too. Some of the conventional treatments included surgery, concentric exercise, stretching, and night splints. One study compared the benefits of eccentric exercises on mid-portion versus insertional tendinosis, and some studies used the contralateral tendon as a control, and still others used no control whatsoever. So at this point, I would like to hand it over to Janice, who's going to talk about the results a bit more.
Okay. So I'm going to get into more of the numbers, number crunching of the results section, and we were supposed to draw straws for this, but apparently you can call shotgun on parts of this, so I didn't know that. So here I go with the outcome measures and more of the numbers. And also, unlike the previous groups before, we didn't actually go into individual studies, but Nick is willing to take answers about those after. So if you have any questions, he's the guru. Okay, outcome measures that we looked at. The main outcome measures were pain and function, and the reasons we chose these outcome measures were because they're clinically significant, quite simply, and budding clinicians and clinicians currently are probably most interested in these particular outcome measures, and they were also included in all the studies that we looked at in some variation. I think I need water. Okay. So when we were comparing pain, it was pretty simple to compare the pain and amalgamate the scores because they used some semblance of an objective scale like the visual analog scale or questionnaires that had objective scores associated with them. There's one exception to that, and that was one study that looked at a subjective expression of pain, so we couldn't include that in the number crunching. With respect to function, it was a completely different situation. So they used a variety of different criteria that they deemed characteristic of, or rather representative of function, and they ranged from return to pre-injury activity level to jumping height and plantar flexion range of motion and or plantar flexion strength rather and dorsiflexion range of motion, and one that was just termed global assessment. So we had more of a difficult time collating those results, but we tried nonetheless. I think that's the next one. So 12 weeks. And the reason that I'm referring to 12 weeks interval is Tracy alluded to it before. The Alfredson and other protocol that was initially the one that sort of spurred the renewed interest in these pain-enduring eccentric exercises as a treatment for Achilles tendinoses, it was a 12-week protocol. So obviously they looked at the results at week zero baseline and then again 12 weeks later. So the studies that tended to follow that used a similar protocol also looked at those intervals. So at 12 weeks in 5 of 8 studies, the pain was significantly improved by an average of about 42%. And in 2 of 8 studies, they didn't actually look at, they didn't have a change at 12 weeks, but they did notice an improvement in pain at different time intervals. So I think up there we have, it was noticed at 6 weeks, 6 months, and at one year. And in 1 of 8 studies, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, pain was only qualitatively recorded, and in that study they were looking at a long-term result, and an average of 3.8 years later, the participants that had gone through this Alfredson and other protocol had noted that they had a little bit of niggling pain left, but that they could still continue with their pre-injury activity levels. Okay, result. For pain. Okay, so that was the eccentric exercise group. So now I'm going to refer to the control group, and Tracy also explained here that the control group wasn't an empirical control group where they didn't receive any treatment. They were a variety of different controls. So, for example, one study they had surgery. In another study, they were given mainly concentric exercises. In another study, they had sort of short duration stretches. So I think it was 5 30-second holds 5 times a day or something like that. And then another study was sustained holds, so it was night splints. So they were different control groups, but And the interesting thing is, in these control groups, the pain was also improved by approximately 34%. So it was also improved, but to a lesser degree. And it's also notable that in 2 of 8 studies, there was no difference between these so-called control groups and the eccentric exercise group. And in both of these studies, stretching was an important, arguably important part of the control group treatment protocol. So Nick is going to touch on that in the discussion section. So for function, the second outcome measure that we looked at, the results were very similar to pain. So we did see an improvement in from baseline of approximately 42% in the eccentric exercise group, but like we saw previously for pain, there was also an improvement in the control groups, but it was to a lesser degree, so 33% instead of the 42%. Okay, so now those are sort of the quick and dirty of the results, amalgamated the results section. But now you have to ask the question of whether we can trust the numbers from the results section. And other than the fact that I was the one who came up with those percentages, there's you have to look at the quality of the control study, the quality of the studies. So to do that, we used 2 different scales. We used the Meagan's and Harris quality assessment scale, and we also used Sackett's levels of evidence. And when we looked at those, we actually got fairly poor results, or not as strong as we might have expected with all the interest in these pain-enduring eccentric exercises for the treatment of Achilles tendinosis. But we have to keep in mind that, I'm sure, as we all know after doing these systematic reviews, that non-randomized control trials tend not to do as well on a lot of these scales. So, and true to form, 4 of ours were prospective cohort studies, and only 4 were randomized control trials. So, and when we used Sackett's levels of evidence, they actually rated as a 2B, the randomized control trials, so a low quality randomized control trials, and the other 4 were poor. I hate using that word, but I think that's what they mentioned in the scales, poor cohort studies. So they didn't do too well. And when we used the Meagan's and Harris scale, they also didn't score as well. Only 3 of the 5 scored as a strong, and then the other 3 of the 8 scored as a strong, and then the other 5 ranked as weak on the Meagan's and Harris scale. Sorry, yeah. And but nonetheless, regardless of the quality of the studies, we did include them all in our systematic review simply because there is such a dearth of evidence or dearth of research in this area. So we included them all, but we also took the opportunity to discuss in our discussion section the limitations of including them all. And Nick is going to go into detail about that.
All right, so as Janice already kind of laid out for you guys, the accumulation of the results in the systematic review suggests that a heavy load eccentric exercise protocol reduces pain and restores function in those with chronic Achilles tendinosis. However, the studies that have been included in this review were not without their limitations, of course. So first of all, while a fair number of studies were reviewed, most of these studies were actually relatively low quality. Most of them weren't randomized, controlled, or blinded. As Janice already mentioned, 4 of the 8 studies ranked at a level 4 on the Sackett's level of evidence, and 5 of the 8 studies were classified as weak on the Meagan's and Harris scale. And also, as Janice already mentioned, we have to note that these scales are generally used to rate randomized controlled trials, which unfortunately is relatively rare in the physiotherapy field. So because of that, we weren't able to disqualify any of the articles based on the lack of literature in this specific area. Now, in addition to the low quality of the studies, it's also interesting to note that many of these studies that have been published in this area came out of the same centers in Sweden, which of course may or may not have introduced bias to the results. Another limitation up there is the method of diagnosis that they used for the tendinopathy, which actually varied between the studies, as Tracy already mentioned. The correct diagnosis, of course, is absolutely crucial, as this ensures that the treatment being prescribed is for the correct condition. ultrasound and MRI are generally the preferred methods to support a diagnosis of this condition. And as was already mentioned, two of the eight studies used only a clinical examination rather than imaging to confirm the diagnosis, while one of the eight studies did actually use imaging, but not on every single subject. For this reason, it's possible that these three studies included subjects that didn't actually have a true chronic Achilles tendinosis, which of course may skew our results. The fourth limitation up there is the wide range of control groups or conventional treatments that were used in the control groups, which makes it very difficult for us to compare the results between the different studies. And as Janice mentioned, most of these control groups also showed improvement in pain and function, just like the eccentric group. But of course, these results were generally considered to be less substantial than the eccentric training groups. What is interesting is that the two studies that failed to find the difference between the conventional and eccentric training groups both involve stretching as part of the control group, which may emphasize the importance of actually including stretching as part of the treatment protocol. And lastly, a variety of outcome measures were used in all the studies, again making it very difficult to perform a meta-analysis or to compare data across studies. And just a few points worth noting here. While this systematic review that we focused on was specifically on mid-portion tendinosis, there was actually a slight disagreement on the actual definition of mid-portion between the authors in the studies that we looked at. But even though the exact location of the lesion is of course important, like a centimeter or so difference is unlikely to be clinically relevant. What might actually prove to be more important clinically is the difference between mid-portion and insertional tendinosis. And even though our review focused on a mid-portion, two of the eight studies that we included in our review actually did look at both mid-portion and insertional Achilles tendinosis, and the results from both of these studies actually showed that the eccentric exercise protocol may actually be less effective in the insertional group. And why that is, we don't really know, but one of the authors from the study suggested that the difference in effectiveness may have been due to the fact that it appears to be more of a mechanical problem in the insertional group, such as the bone impinging on an inflamed bursar tendon, rather than having a true tendinosis. And in their study, the imaging results actually showed a mixed pattern in those with so-called insertional tendinosis, which included bursitis and bone pathology, which again stresses the importance of confirming the correct diagnosis. And it's apparent from all of this that it's more studies are needed to study the effect of the eccentric protocol on insertional tendinosis. Second point worth noting is that almost all the studies had a disproportionately higher number of male patients to female patients, as was mentioned earlier. However, it's also been shown that the male gender is actually an etiological factor in the development of chronic Achilles tendinosis, which can actually account for these, may account for these skewed ratios. So the question remains, is conventional treatment actually significantly less effective than a heavy load eccentric exercise protocol as the treatment for chronic Achilles tendinosis? And also, what about stretching? How important is it to include stretching as part of the treatment program? And lastly, how comfortable are we as clinicians asking our patients to exercise through pain? So as our conclusion, we found that the evidence is definitely convincing, and we understand that the current shift towards this type of treatment also seems justified. And of course, it's absolutely crucial for us as clinicians to base our treatments on both clinical judgment and the best available evidence. And the studies that we reviewed suggest that the treatments involving the pain enduring eccentric exercises are in fact superior to conventional treatments. So what exactly do we recommend? I'm going to pass it on to Claire, who will finish off her presentation with the clinical recommendations and also some new and exciting research in this area.
Okay, so I guess this brings us down to what could be considered our bottom line, and that's what we would recommend to a clinician for the treatment of chronic Achilles tendinosis. And oftentimes in physiotherapy, what is done clinically and what shows good results clinically is not always supported in the literature, and this could be one of those times. The results do look promising, but they're certainly not conclusive, especially when we're asking a patient to push through pain. Therefore, we recommend a pain-free program until further research, until further research of higher rigor can support this method of treatment. And however, we can, of course, leave this decision up to your professional discretion. So as physiotherapy is a dynamic field and there's always research coming out, there was bound to be some articles that came out just after we finished our review. So through our email updates from databases, a couple came in and they were really interesting and had interesting results, and they might help direct future research. So we thought it would be important just to quickly mention them at the end here. So the first was by Sayana and Mafuli, and it just came out recently in 2006. And what they had indicated in their article was that they had been using the heavy load eccentric protocol within their clinic, and they had been having good results, but noticed that they were getting slightly less good results with their non-athletic patients that had chronic Achilles tendinosis. So therefore, they carried out a prospective study. They had 34 patients, and they were all subjects that did not frequently exercise and did not were not involved in any regular sports activity. So after completing the eccentric protocol, the same one for 12 weeks, they found that the results were unexpectedly lower than they had anticipated. So more patients went on to have surgeries and injections into their tendon than had been found previously in other studies. So the results do indicate that there may in fact be less of a beneficial effect on patients that are non-athletic with the same condition. However, there's several limitations in the study, so once again, it requires us to look for more research in this area. Okay. So the second study was conducted to determine the mechanism behind why eccentric exercise is effective and how that actually works. And previously, there's been other hypotheses, and one possible mechanism was that it affects the neovascularization in the injured tendon. And with the repeated lowering, there's actually a cutoff of the blood supply to these vessels and nerves in that area, and thereby resulting in ischemic damage to those, as we mentioned, they're poor quality blood vessels that shouldn't actually be there. This study, however, found that the mechanism may be a result of changes in collagen metabolism in the tendon. They had 12 subjects. They were all elite soccer players. Six of them had chronic Achilles tendinosis, and six were used as healthy controls. They all completed the 12-week eccentric protocol, and they found that the patients with the injured tendons all had responded to the program by having increased collagen synthesis rates within the tendon. Conversely, the tendons of the six healthy subjects showed no subsequent increase in collagen synthesis rates. And all six of the injured subjects did improve and return to sport following the study. The authors do suggest that this data may indicate that the cause of the condition is a deficit in strength in the tendon tissue, and it's unable to adapt to the physical activity level of the patient. Therefore, eccentric training would reduce the strength deficit and thereby removing the pain. Now again, future research is needed in this area just to help confirm this possible mechanism of action, as it's with hopefully with higher samples, number of people. Okay. So the last comment we wanted to make was in regards to outcome measures. And as we pointed out in the presentation, for function, there was a wide variety of outcome measures used, and it really made it difficult to compare between studies. And in 2001, Robertson et al. Came out with this questionnaire. It's the VISA-A questionnaire, and it's to measure clinical severity of Achilles tendinosis. And it stands for the Victorian Institute of Sports Assessment Achilles. So it consists of 8 questions, and they all ask the patient about pain, function, and activity. It's been shown to be both reliable and valid, and it can be used in both research and clinically because it is quite easy to administer. It was also just used in the study I just mentioned by Sayana and Mafuli, so hopefully it can be used in other research and it can help make comparison between studies easier. Okay. So these are many references. I just want to thank you. This is just, you may have seen it before, but just throughout the time of our putting this together, we felt like this a few times. So just for our own interest, I'd like to pose the same question to you that we asked in the beginning. Just by show of hands, how many of you would ask your client with chronic Achilles tendinosis to follow a pain enduring eccentric exercise program? A lot of indecisive hands out there. So, okay. So that's interesting. Maybe a few less. But thank you for your time and attention, and we'll turn it over to you for any questions. Brenda in the back.
I can feel the first part maybe. I know the two studies that you're talking about, one of them was, the question was in the two studies that we talked about where there's no significant difference between the two, the control and the eccentric exercise group with respect to pain, there was stretching included in those two studies, and the question was, what was the stretching protocol and why might that have helped? And with the two studies, one of them was Silbernagel and others, and the other one was Noregard, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing both of those incorrectly, but Noregard and others. And in the first one, I believe, and Nick, you might want to correct me on this if I'm wrong, I believe they were 20-second holds 5 times a day, so, and they were just stretching your calf or your plantar flexors in a seated position with, say, a towel or whatever, a strap of some sort. And Claire might want to speak to the Noregard and other protocol.
Yeah, I think the Noregard was a standing stretch, and it was held for 20 to 30 seconds, done 3 times. Can't remember how many times a day, but it was at least once a day. It might have been twice, actually.
And the reasoning that it might have helped is a lot of the different reviews we read or a lot of the different references that we resourced with respect to why stretching did help was just that a shortened Achilles tendon or a shortened Achilles plantar flexors may not be able to absorb the load as well. So if you stretch it out, it might just, it's more pliable, and then therefore you're going to be dispersing the forces over a larger area when you do your activities running or jump, landing from a jump or whatnot. But that was just a theory that was presented. And I don't believe, to the best of my knowledge, that there's anything proven as to why stretching would help, but that was proposed as potentially why.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry. Megan?
You mentioned that basically most programs were 12 weeks long, and at the end of 12 weeks, pain was likely to decrease. Is there sort of a critical period in which they'd have to endure pain for so many weeks and then it would get better? And would you be able to sort of tell your patients, you know, if you can suck it up for this long, then you know, there's a good chance it'll be longer, or was that really varied or not reported?
No, it was pointed out. Does anybody else have a question?
Yeah. So the question was, how long is the most, how much pain is there for how long? Like, is there a point where it gets better? And they didn't really address that in terms of saying at such and such it's way better. But in some of the reading we came across where they were hypothesizing about the mechanism of why eccentric training might work, some of those authors were saying that they thought perhaps, they commented that the first 2 weeks in some of their studies, the patients had a lot of pain, and then it got better. And they thought that might be, as Claire had said earlier, because of cutting off of the blood supply and the nerves that go along with that, and the nerves were causing the pain, but basically then they're being deadened. So, and they're not supposed to be there, those blood vessels. So in those, that kind of came in as saying 2 weeks, but I don't think really any of the papers specifically stated.
I think, Megan, is your question?
Is that?
I thought I misinterpreted it then. I thought you were asking when you're prescribing these exercises, how long do you have to tell them to endure the pain? Is that what your question was?
No, more likely it's like,
oh, okay,
you know,
sorry.
Is there a point after 4 weeks you should expect less pain, or 6 weeks
okay.
you should expect less pain?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that wasn't.
I think they generally do decrease in pain, and that's why they bump up the weight they have to. So I guess they're always supposed to be feeling some pain. They didn't quantify it throughout the whole.
I see one of the, like the Silvernagel article, I know they did the visual analog scale, and they said, they told them to get the pain up to about a level 5, and if it decreased past that, then they would increase the weight until it reaches a level 5 again. So like they didn't really say when they stopped decreasing pain, but I'm assuming if the lesion's still there, you're doing eccentric exercises with increasing load, you're going to keep feeling the pain until it's completely gone. Aaron?
Can I just clarify, when they're measuring pain, is that just pain during the exercise, or did they do some sort of a home journal?
Yeah, I know they did do different studies, looked at, oh, sorry. The question was, I'm bad at this. The question was if they qualified when they were feeling the pain. Obviously, pain is a pretty broad category. Yeah, some of the studies looked at pain on palpation, and others looked at pain with activity, but we looked at pain, all the ones that were, and I hate to say it, the Alfredson protocol, but the Alfredson et others, and I feel bad for the et others because we always call it the Alfredson protocol, but that protocol, they were looking at pain with activity. So be it whatever their activity was that they had pain with, they would find out if they still had pain with that activity. There was a couple of studies that looked at pain on palpation, but those studies also looked at pain with activity. So we compared the pain with activity results. Yeah.
And just to add to that, some studies did record soreness, like muscle soreness due to the exercises, but they didn't specifically lay out how they did that. And that's why one of our articles actually changed the Alfredson protocol a little bit to slow down the increasing of the reps, just to negate that soreness or try to solve that problem.
Mike? I can't remember if you addressed it or not, but did all the patients that were undergoing treatment, did they cease their activity or whatever was predisposing them to, whatever was predisposing them to a tendinopathy, did they cease that during this treatment?
So the question was, if the subject stopped the activity that was causing pain during the intervention, the study intervention. I don't think they specifically... Some studies did allow them to keep running. They didn't... Pain-free running. But I don't think they recorded that. And most of the subjects were included in the study because they weren't physically able to do a lot of the activities anymore because due to pain. But can anyone answer that better?
Go ahead.
I was just going to mention to you, and some of the that comes up with some of the compliance when we're looking at compliance and dropouts, and I think it was a mix. Some of the studies were more stringent about having them cease other things, and some of them allowed them to do more things. That came up when you're reading about their compliance and what they're still doing, or if they kept a journal. So it was sort of both, I think, is probably the best answer. And then, like Tracy's, she's disappeared. Like Tracy said too, some of them really were in so much pain that they weren't doing much. So,
Just that in the Alfredson papers, they did say you were allowed to continue with activities that you would normally do as long as they're pain-free. So if you can get back to pain-free running, you're welcome to do it. But they didn't record that, like Tracy said. So we have no way of knowing exactly what they did.
Which is the effect? Is it the stop?
Yeah. Exactly. And that would definitely be a limitation, yeah. That's a good point. Sorry.
That was a very interesting presentation. Thank you. I'm just intrigued when you look at what the results are and you're recognizing that there's probably some heterogeneity within the patient mix, the characteristics of the patients that are used in the study. Now that you've done this literature review, and let's suppose that you can get a grant worth a lot of money, and you have a lot of time, and you have infinite resources, how would you then decide in your method for your next study what your characteristics of your patients would be in order to address some of these questions about different patient characteristics?
I'll go. You want to go?
Repeat the question.
Okay. So if we had all the money in the world from a grant, an endless grant, where would we take this research with respect to the subject characteristics? And I think a couple of the things that were pointed out was they seemed to find in two studies anyway a difference in what was proposed, potentially a difference in the effectiveness of the eccentric protocol and body mass index, and the effectiveness in the protocol and women versus men, women tending not to do as well, the effectiveness of the protocol in sedentary individuals versus active individuals. So, I mean, that would be great if you could do that, if you could compare those, tease those out, and do sedentary versus active, you could do women versus men, insertional versus mid-portion, because the insertional didn't do as well. But again, as Nick pointed out, a lot of those had to get surgery, and so they got to see the tendon, and it was actually in fact retrocalcaneal bursitis or non-tendinopathies, really. So it would be interesting if you could do a proper MRI or an ultrasound and know that it's a tendinopathy insertionally, and then compare it to a mid portion and see if it still is, you get different results. So that's where I would like to take it if I had the mojo and the money.
Yeah, I think it's interesting from a clinical point of view, because that's what the clinician needs to do, is you look at the research, but you say that how many of my patients fit the characteristics of these particular studies.
Yeah.
And so it's not just saying, okay, well, there's enough evidence to say push through pain, but there might be enough evidence to say with patients with these characteristics, at this stage of this pathology, under these conditions, then I would recommend for that subgroup.
And I think another thing is, depending on the patient that you have, would they comply with pushing through pain? So I know if I gave my mother eccentric exercises to do that push through pain, she'd rather have a cup of tea, you know? I don't think she would actually do them. So I think you have to read your patient too and see what compliance you would get from that, whereas a hardcore athlete might be more willing to. And if you had the evidence to back you up, it might be more of a feasible option. Sorry.
So this relates to what we're talking about. Did they report the compliance rate in that study in sedentary individuals?
They did actually, and but that wasn't. Oh, sorry. Repeat the question. So the question was whether they reported the compliance rate in the study that looked at sedentary individuals, and that one wasn't actually included in our review. But they did report the compliance rate, and it was high, and they said it was actually higher than some of the other studies that we did include in our review.
Of the studies you included in your review, did any of them vary the speed of eccentric loading, or was it, and also was the exercise always just the eccentric phase, or did any incorporate the stretch shortening cycle where they actually followed the eccentric with concentric?
Is that the only one? The question is whether any of the articles did they only follow the eccentric protocol like Alfredson, or did some incorporate concentric stretching or
varying speeds
and just varying the fit principle or whatnot? The only article that I remember is the Silbernagel one, which it was actually a really complicated protocol where they had three phases, 4 weeks each, 12 weeks in total. The first phase was mainly concentric and stretching, a little bit of eccentric. The next 4 weeks they would incorporate more eccentric, taking out the concentric, and actually the last phase they would incorporate a little bit of plyometrics and more of the stretch shortening cycle. And they also showed improvement in function.
Yeah.
That's right. But then the control group also incorporated all three components as well, even though it wasn't as in depth. It was a 12-week program with just light concentric, a tiny bit of eccentric, and stretching, and that's it.
Yeah, and actually, I know in I think it was 1984 or something like that, Stanish and Kerwin, I think it was, or Stanish and others, they actually varied. The reason that Alfredson even became involved, or I shouldn't say for sure, but this is what I read. The reason that he was interested in these is that Stanish and Kerwin were one of the first to incorporate eccentric, and they did vary the speeds, but then he didn't. He did it very slowly, and I know that he rehabbed himself, right? That's where it started from, and then after that, he's like, oh, well, let's do a pilot study with... He had 15 recreational athletes, and it was a pilot study, no real control, a surgery group. And he found that the surgery group also got back to activity, but 24 weeks later, whereas his group, his eccentric group, got back, all 15 got back 12 weeks later. So then it progressed from there. So then he did another study with another fellow named Maffey, and they tried to compare concentric with eccentric. And concentric did improve, but not as much. And then he decides to do a bigger study with a fellow named Falstrom, so it's Falstrom and others, and Alfredson's in that group too, and they incorporate 101 tendons, so they're trying to increase, so it's, he's been trying to build on this, but he hasn't addressed that different speed. He's always done the same slow, but the initial one, which was that Stanish paper, they did do different speeds, so that's a good question. I don't know, he's never addressed that, why he didn't vary the speeds, but I'm not sure.
I'm sort of curious, if we're looking at loading the tendon to stimulate, for example, this hypothesis of collagen,
yeah,
metabolism, what part of the exercise actually stimulates the maximal loading? Is it at, you know, slow eccentric, fast,
yeah,
eccentric, or is it that transition of eccentric to concentric?
Yeah,
which
and
is
that's
a functional,
yeah,
function of the muscle tendon.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I never found it addressed at all.
Yeah.
And I don't know if any of you guys did either, no.
Thanks. Like, just to add to that, like the people that were allowed to run,
yeah,
like running is repetitive plyometric.
Yeah. And
a lot of the people that were, the comment was that maybe running was actually what was contributing to the healing rather than could be. Yeah. A lot of the subjects, from what I understand, were actually running up to the start of the intervention as well. And I can't say for sure, but it seemed that some of those were the ones that were going to continue running through the intervention. So I could maybe suggest that they were running up to the point where they started the intervention as well. So that alone wasn't solving the problem. But that's just suggestion.
One last question. When you say comparing to conservative,
yeah,
did you find anything that you want to report from your review on what conservative?
Yeah, that runs the gamut, I think. Okay. So the question is what we think is conservative treatment, and it ran the gamut from everywhere, from concentric and eccentric to the stretching to getting NSAIDs for something that is really, now they don't believe is inflammatory at all. So I think the conservative treatment, and that's the thing. It would have been beautiful if we could have found enough papers to compare the eccentric versus a specific conservative treatment, but they were all over the place, and there was nothing that I could find, and I don't believe these guys either because we discussed it, that was specifically stated to be a conservative treatment that was effective or abundantly used out there, but it was all over the place, and there's that one slide that you showed that had a bunch of treatments, but yeah, sorry, I can't answer that better.
Yeah, I was just going to comment to you, and there were modalities used, but yeah, the papers didn't define it. We wondered as well, we discussed if thinking about what happens clinically, if perhaps people are using more concentric for a time period and then switching over to eccentric as a conventional treatment, whereas this was doing the eccentric drops right away. So we had just wondered if that also was a typical thing that was happening, but they didn't define it. So it was just a whole mishmash of things, so.
Any other questions?
Okay, well, we'll wrap
that. I'm so bored by these clinical questions. I have some methodological I don't think in the... You used the more recent set, the 2001 Oxford ones. Do they I don't think they do. Do they define what a low quality RCT is?
I don't. The question was, does Sackett's level of evidence defined what a low quality RCT? I don't even think they had a
a category called low quality RCT.
Actually, yeah, here.
Do they?
Oh. So to an individual.
Two B.
Yeah, no, and you know, we talked about that a while ago, and honestly, I can't remember.
I would like to know what your definition.
Yeah, I know, and you know, we did talk about this, but honestly, I'm not trying to shirk this question,
no.
We talked about it a while ago, and we did bang heads about it, because we were wondering the exact
because
same question.
They don't define it to
no.
my knowledge. Did anybody find it?
Yeah, and we did come up with some way, and I apologize, but I don't remember exactly what we decided, but we did have this the same discussion. And
I mean, it's terrible that they don't define their
Yeah, remember when we were like, how do we know if it's a good RCT?
I think we spoke to Donna about this question. I don't want to misquote you, but I thought maybe it had to do with the number
Darlene.
Of subjects. Sorry, Darlene. Maybe it had something to do with the number of subjects included and the power of the study. But I
yeah, the earlier ones did, but and then I promise this is the last one. One of your early slides where you showed why you omitted most of those 153, there was one that had been, the same study was published in two different journals. Was it exactly the same?
You actually read that slide?
No, just kidding.
Yeah. No, that took the question was that we disqualified one of our articles because we believed that the data was used in a different study. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, basically it said the same study was published in
Yeah, that actually took a little bit of investigation because, as an earlier group mentioned, or somebody had mentioned, that the subject numbers weren't exactly the same. So we had to look at the intervention and a number of things, and we truly believed that those were the same data, and there was just a few subjects that were added onto that. It was the same intervention, same researchers,
yeah.
same...
It just looked, and it was within the same time span.
And it was actually, they were looking at two different things. So I think that they used the same subjects to look at two different things, but what we were teasing out of the two studies, the same. So we couldn't use both articles. And we did email, and did we get a response?
Did they respond?
No, he did.
No response.
And that's another bone I have to
pick. You mailed the journal editor. No response. Thank you. I should...